So you're recording the podcast, is that what you do? All right, welcome all. Thank you for joining us in our your lunch break. Hope you've enjoyed the light refreshments that we provided. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Federica D'Alessandra and I'm the Executive Director of a new Oxford Program on International Peace and Security. We are housed here at the Blavatnik School of Government under the Institute for Ethics, Law and Armed Conflict, also known as ELEC.
Is your microphone on?
Is it? Yeah.
It is.
You cannot hear me?
Your okay. Voice is coming, but not the microphone.
Okay.
Can I check with
someone? I don't know.
How is it in the back?
I don't know how to do that. Okay.
Some of us might be...
do you want me to try and speak louder?
Okay, so I'm going to...
If you would kindly.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, then we'll have an interlude in the meanwhile. I was just introducing myself.
Thank you. I don't mean to stop you.
Well, if you can't hear me. In any case, we'll have to do it again because a few more people are taking a seat, so we'll wait for Ivo. Where is that?
Yeah, I have somebody.
Can
you give us a test?
Yeah, sure. Test. Can you hear me? 1, 2, 3. Test, mic.
How is it in the front? Is it better?
All right. So, sorry about that. Just to welcome everyone again, my name is Federica D'Alessandra. I'm the Executive Director of the Oxford Program on International Peace and Security, which is housed here at the Blavatnik School of Government under the Institute for Ethics, Law and Armed Conflict, also known as ELEC. Our shared research office is on the first floor, for those of you here at the school, whereas my personal office is in room 36 on the third floor, and my door is always open if you want to learn more about our work here at the school. ELEC is an interdisciplinary research institute working on strengthening the norms, laws, and institutions that seek to restrain, regulate, and prevent armed conflict. Professor Dapo Akande, who teaches here at the MPP program, and Professor Yanina Dell of DPIR are our co-directors, and I'm pleased that a number of our research fellows, as well as our research project manager, Lindsay, are here with us. ELEC and the Program on International Peace and Security, or IPS as we call it, focus on, to a certain degree, equally on the recourse to violence, the prevention of atrocities on set, the conduct of hostilities, including the protection of civilians in armed conflict, as well as the termination of conflict, including peacekeeping and stability operations, exit strategies, post-conflict power arrangements, and transitional justice. We work both at the normative level as well as by looking at the operationalization of these norms. One key dimension of our work is that while studying the traditional institutions with competence in these matters and the limits to their powers, we also try to understand the role of non-state groups as well as the role of individual leaders in each of these dimensions by looking at the ways in which authority and the content of norms evolves in response to their increased prominence in what have been traditionally state-centered and state-focused conversations. The Program on International Peace and Security in particular also focuses on broader issues of global governance, leadership, and multilateralism vis-a-vis our collective security. It is against this background that today we bring you a conversation on the impact that the much talked about field of international criminal justice, one of the key components of our work, is having on our collective security and the evolution of norms, such as the expectation of seeing perpetrators of mass violence held to account when the guns fall silent. Before I introduce the topic and our speaker, however, I would like to invite Ivo Gruev, co-convener of the Oxford Transitional Justice Research Group, that is a co-sponsoring entity of today's discussion, to take the floor and say a few words about OTJR.
Thank you very much, Federica, for this opportunity. Welcome, everyone. Thanks for sharing this event with us. Welcome to Professor Assadat. We're honored to have the opportunity to host you with us here today. I'll just say a couple of words about Oxford Transitional Justice, which is the co-sponsor of this event. OTJR has been running for more than 10 years now. It's an institution hosted at the Law Faculty, anchored at the Center for Criminology at the Law Faculty of the University of Oxford. And our principal aim is to facilitate a platform for exchange, scholarship, and a marketplace of ideas, covering issues of transitional justice broadly defined from, and this is quite important, also an interdisciplinary background. So over the last almost 12 years, we've been bringing speakers from practice and academia with a background from a variety of disciplines such as law, political science, international relations, sociology, anthropology, visual artists as well, and so on. We do pride ourselves in our interdisciplinary approach, and in this light, I'm very happy about the opportunity to have our first co-hosted or co-sponsored event with the Blavatnik School and ELAC, through Federica D'Alessandro, who I met at the beginning of this academic year, and I'm very happy about this new bridge that we're establishing and look forward to further ways of cooperation. My name, once again, Ivo Gruev, and I'm actually doing a DPhil in socio-legal studies at the Law Faculty. I don't want to take away any more time from the center of our debate and conversation today, so I just hand over to Federica, yes, who is going to introduce our speaker today. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you, Ivo. Now, all of you attending this talk presumably will be familiar with the history of international criminal justice, so there's no need to spend much time on it. Suffice it to say that its institutional beginnings are traced by many of the international military tribunals at Tokyo and Nuremberg at the end of World War II, though the intellectual beginnings, really, of its modern conceptualizations especially date back to at least the end of World War I. Its founding principles being that the international community could and should organize itself around norms and institutions to prevent and punish mass violence, and that no individual, no matter how powerful, can be above the law, and those who inflict systematic and widespread brutality upon armless civilians should not go unpunished. Since its beginning, the field was very controversial, as it butted heads with traditional conceptions of state power and their privileges, and also because of it being so intertwined by its very nature, actually, with contemporary political dynamics. After a hiatus that lasted until the early 90s, it was only thanks to a window of political opportunity created by the fall of the Soviet Union, a newfound sense of unity within the UN Security Council, that the field entered its second phase with the establishment of the UN International Criminal Tribunals for the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda, that were then followed, not in the order in which I list them, by a number of ad hoc and hybrid tribunals instated for Lebanon after the assassination of former Prime Minister Rafiki Riri, Cambodia to try the Khmer Rouge regime in a set of extraordinary chambers, including on counts of genocides, as well as Sierra Leone, to address crimes committed in the context of the civil war, as well as crimes perpetrated in neighboring Liberia. And given the proliferation of such institutions around the 90s, it should be no surprise that the international community came together to set up a permanent international criminal tribunal. It did so in 1998, as you all will know, with the establishment of the International Criminal Court. And 20 years after its establishment, the field as a whole has been evaluating its impact and track record. And so we've brought for you one of the foremost experts in the field to have this conversation with us. Professor Leila Nadia Sadat is a James Carr Professor of International Criminal Law at the Washington University Law and Director of Harris World Law Institute. Since 2012, she's been serving as a Special Advisor on Crimes Against Humanity to the International Criminal Court Prosecutor. And in 2008, she launched the Crimes Against Humanity Initiative to address the scourge of global atrocity crimes and draft a treaty on their punishment and prevention. Professor Sadat is an award-winning scholar who recently received an honorary doctorate from Northwestern University. She's the president of the International Law Association American Branch and a member of the U.S. Council on Foreign Relations. The way we'll proceed is that we'll hear preliminary thoughts from her, and then we will have a Q&A, and it is our hope that you'll be able to participate in that phase. So without further ado, Leila, the floor is all yours. I think that's the closest way you can go.
Okay. Thank you so much, Federica. It's really a thrill to be here at Oxford. It's actually my first time, other than as a tourist sort of peering around the grounds about 25 years ago. So it's wonderful to be here, and it's really wonderful that you arranged not only beautiful weather, but that so many of you came when you could have been outdoors doing something else. The title of my talk is called Current Challenges to International Justice, Lean In or Leave, and I hope that doesn't ring too upsetting for those of you in the UK who have been dealing with the Leave campaign for, 3 years now, almost. I probably should have entitled it Current Challenges to the International Criminal Court, because there have been really an awful lot going on about the International Criminal Court, and so I'm going to really focus on the ICC. I think Federica mentioned that I'm the Special Advisor on Crimes Against Humanity to the ICC prosecutor. Obviously, I speak completely in my personal academic capacity and not on behalf of the office in my remarks today, and nothing I say should in any way be attributed to the office of the prosecutor or any organ of the court. I'd like very much to thank Federica D'Alessandro and Ivo Gruev, did I say that right, Ivo? The Blatnik School of Government and the Oxford Transitional Justice Research Project, I guess, for inviting me. Group. For inviting me here. And I hope that we'll have a conversation. I do have some remarks, because I'd like to sort of set out my thesis about some of this, and then I hope that'll generate some ideas and you can criticize it, because this is the first time I'm sort of rolling out this iteration of my thoughts about what is going on at the ICC right now. I'd like to explain a little bit more what the court does, because maybe not everybody in the room is an expert on the ICC. Sort of some of the challenges to the court that are sounding, as I say, like a leave campaign in some quarters, and why I think, actually, that we ought to be leaning in rather than leaving, and we should work to assist, reform, and help to prosper this very important international institution. Most of you know that the ICC statute was adopted on July 17, 1998, in the city of Rome. I had the good fortune to be present at the creation. I participated both in the negotiations prior to the adoption of the statute, again on behalf of the International Law Association, not on behalf of a government, and I attended the Rome conference as an NGO delegate. It was an extraordinary event. Anybody else here present in Rome in 98? It was pretty amazing. I was obviously a very, very young scholar at the time. I'd never been to a diplomatic meeting, and this one was attended by 250 non-governmental organizations, 165 governments, many of which brought large delegations. As Federica noted in her introduction, the creation of the court was something that was possible because of the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1989, the General Assembly deemed the 1990s the decade of international law and set about creating lots of international institutions and innovations. But we also had seen the war in the former Yugoslavia, with an estimated death count of 200,000, 50,000 rapes, detention, persecution, ethnic cleansing, and a variety of other crimes in Europe, on European soil. And we saw, of course, in 1994, the Rwandan genocide. And so the notion that the international institutions that we had were sufficient to contain what appeared to be ongoing atrocity crimes in the world was clearly not the case. We had the UN and many other institutions, but we had not yet created a permanent international criminal court, the one that was envisaged by the Genocide Convention in 1948, because of Cold War politics, essentially. So states came to Rome to create this new institution, and the fact that it emerged after 5 weeks of negotiation is nothing short than a miracle. It really is. And I think we have to start there, because whether or not we decide the institution is worth saving or not, we have to think about why we created it in the first place. In Rome, they made some pretty important decisions about how the court would work. They decided that the court, unlike the International Court of Justice, this court would have what they called inherent jurisdiction, essentially universal jurisdiction, over three crimes: genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes. That means every state that joined the court accepted jurisdiction over those crimes. There was a minor opt-out for war crimes, which I won't discuss. It was also decided, though, that having said that the court will have universal jurisdiction over the three crimes, there would be limits on the actual jurisdiction of the court. In cases brought to the court by states or by the prosecutor, you would have to either have the consent or the jurisdiction of the state of nationality of the accused or the territorial state. So we had two principles of sort of classic jurisdiction in international law that were overlaid over the universality of the Rome Statute in cases brought either by the prosecutor or by states, not by the Security Council. The council could refer everything it wants. Right? The other thing is that in cases brought by the prosecutor on his or her own initiative, a pretrial chamber of the court would have to approve before the situation could go forward. So the concern wasn't so much on the law of the ICC, but on the enforcement of that law by the organs of the court. And so states have there's very broad in jurisdiction in sort of the theoretical sense. But when it comes to the application, it's much narrower. And finally, the court is meant to be, quote, complementary to national systems, meaning that if any state, not just a state party to the statute, but the United States or the Russian Federation or some other state is investigating or prosecuting a case that could otherwise be before the court, that case becomes inadmissible. So sometimes you'll hear of this as a court of last, not first resort, and that's what they mean. Any state can basically stop the ICC from going forward if it opens an investigation into the crime. So at the time of the court's creation, there was a lot of excitement about this. It seemed like a powerful jurisdictional regime tempered by concerns about state sovereignty, national security, etc. But it was understood that the fights that had taken place at Rome were going to continue into the post-Rome period, and there was some skepticism about how quickly this court could get underway. The statute required 60 ratifications to bring the treaty into force, which happened in 4 years, which was astonishing. Everybody thought it was going to be 10, 20 years. It was going to take a very, very long time, because we'd seen other institutions that had very, very high numbers of ratifications required take a long time. So the idea that this would happen in less than 4 years was surprising. The NGO Coalition for the International Criminal Court, which grouped together at Rome about 800 non-governmental organizations and now has over 2,000, I think, set as its goals for the treaty a fair, effective and independent court. As the court has become operational, we're now 21 years almost after the statute, the question is whether those goals have been met: fair, effective, independent, right? So we at least had some criteria for the entry into when the court was created. Well, if we take a look at the court today, we see that it has 900 staff from over 100 countries. It has 123 states parties. It's grown pretty fast. It has 11 situations currently under investigation, 27 cases pending or complete, and 10 additional preliminary examinations underway, which I'll come back to, making it really, really busy. It's a justice startup, as one American lawyer called it, tasked with prosecuting and investigating the most serious crimes of concern to the international community as a whole. And I think, as Federica presaged in her introduction, this court is bound up in interstate politics in a way that's really quite hard to separate out. Turning the ICC statute into a blueprint for a functioning and high-performing international institution has been thrilling, and it's also been very difficult. And there have been unanticipated difficulties, in part from the structure that was created and in part because the world changes in 20 years. It has a much more difficult mandate than the ad hoc international criminal tribunals that were established after the Rwandan genocide and during the conflict in the Yugoslavia situation, because it is so broad, right? If you look at the situations, they're literally all over the world. It also is working in peacetime, not just in wartime, and it's working in situations of active conflict. Unlike the ad hoc tribunals as well, it can't rely on the Security Council's Chapter 7 powers for enforcement, although we think it should be able to in the two situations the council referred, but the council hasn't really done that. But the Yugoslavia and the Rwanda tribunal were backed by much heavier sort of consensus and ability to use enforcement power, if you like, of the council. That said, those tribunals, not so much the Rwanda, but the Yugoslavia tribunal, struggled mightily to get custody of their accused, and only recently, fairly recently, did so. They've had some significant successes. They've had convictions for child soldiering in the Lubanga case, attacks on cultural property and heritage in the Almaty case, but we've also clearly had some setbacks. There's not yet been a single conviction for sexual violence, even though many, many of the cases at the court are cases in which campaigns of rape and other forms of sexual violence are endemic. So that's disappointing. The focus of the ICC on victims is much more substantial than at the ad hoc tribunals. We have a trust fund for victims that actually works independently of the court, and victims can actually participate. But we've also seen a lot of challenges, critiques of the court's legitimacy from states and non-states parties, difficulties with apprehending accused. There are 15 accused at large at this point. We've seen some of the trials take a long time, difficult questions of proof, problematic jurisprudence coming out, and jurisprudential methodology. We've seen critics say, on the one hand, that the court is too strong and it's too weak, that it's targeting Africa because it's a neo-colonial tool of the West and the United States, and at the same time, the United States is arguing that it's politically motivated because it was looking at the situation in Afghanistan. We've seen the prosecutor criticized for taking on high-ranking defendants like al-Bashir of Sudan, and then we've seen the prosecutor criticized because in the Lubanga case, the defendant wasn't high-ranking enough. Daryl Robinson has written a nice piece about this, saying it seems no matter what it does, the ICC cannot win. And the court occupies, to paraphrase the late Patricia Wald, who served at the ICTY, she was an American judge of great distinction, she says, you know, these courts operate a small center in a whirling international vortex in which almost everything they do has political implications. So you would expect a certain degree of criticism that seems to go with the territory, but it's hard not to see that the court is now facing an avalanche of criticism that seems different in kind from the critiques that I've sort of mentioned so far. basically, what I'd like to say in my short time with you is we have the beginnings of a leave campaign. That should resonate in this country. States don't like being the target or the potential target of ICC investigations, and so we've seen Burundi and the Philippines withdraw after investigations have begun of crimes allegedly committed on their territories in the case of Burundi, and even in the case of a preliminary examination with respect to the Philippines. We've also seen states that signed the statute and cooperated more or less for some time, but now they've can't unsign, but they've sent letters saying they aren't intending to ratify and therefore have no obligations under international law based on their signature, and that includes the United States, Russian Federation, and Israel. And the situation with the United States, I would say, is particularly tense. The United States has had a love-hate relation, maybe not even love, a like-hate relationship with the ICC since the outset. And its contribution to sort of the leave campaign has been historically headed by somebody named John Bolton. He's currently the National Security Advisor of the United States. During the second Bush term, Bush 43, he was Undersecretary for Arms Control and Disarmament. And he argued that the ICC, his goal was that it should wither and die. The Obama administration took a much more sort of constructive engagement approach, but with the current administration, Mr. Bolton is again going after the ICC. And on March 15th, 2019, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo restated the objections. And I'll just read these because they do echo things in the leave campaign. Restated the objections to the ICC because of its, quote, broad, unaccountable prosecutorial powers and the threat it poses to American national sovereignty. He announced a policy of visa restrictions on individuals directly responsible for any ICC investigation of U.S. personnel, and cited in particular the Afghanistan situation, where the prosecutor had filed an application to the pretrial chamber to open an investigation into crimes committed on Afghan territory since 2002, the bulk of which would have been Taliban crimes, because crimes against humanity and war crimes were asserted. The second tranche of that application involved war crimes committed by Afghan national forces, which were much smaller. And then the final tranche was potentially crimes committed by the United States and other state party nationals in torturing individuals on Afghan territory or in places within the jurisdiction of the court. And the United States was upset about that and so decided to revoke the prosecutor's visa. So her visa has been revoked quite publicly. She was allowed to travel to UN headquarters because the United States says that it will respect the UN headquarters agreement. So she just presented to the UN Security Council recently. And he said, Secretary Pompeo said, visa restrictions will not be the end of our efforts. We're prepared to take additional steps, including economic sanctions, if the ICC doesn't change its course, because the ICC is, quote, attacking America's rule of law. So, in addition, and notice there's no nationality limit there, so individuals of U.S. nationality are wondering as well what might be in store. So in addition to speeches like this, and one could see a historic pattern with respect to the United States, although obviously it's reached sort of new proportions, right? Some academics have recently become extremely critical. If you're following at all the dialogue on Each Will Talk, Douglas Guilfoyle has published three separate pieces. He's an Australian academic, now a fellow with the Australian Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, who wrote on Each Will Talk that, quote, I'm tempted by the idea that the ICC should not have been established as a permanent standing court with a seat in The Hague, but primarily as a mechanism for assisting the creation of chambers and national legal systems with international elements. So this basically was the idea rejected in Rome. It was the idea a little bit of the International Law Commission, and states said, no, we know we have so many crimes and we have so much work. We need something much more independent and much more effective at the international level. So there's obviously a spectrum of views, but I wanted to argue today that this is really a campaign to leave or to create a court that's extraordinarily de minimis, that would not look like the court that was negotiated in 1998 and would essentially, in my view, not be much of a court at all. So in the remainder of my time, I'd like to suggest why I think this is not the right idea, right? I think the sort of leave campaign, the idea of whacking the ICC down to size or withdrawing from the ICC if a state doesn't like what's going on at the court is not useful. And there's sort of three reasons, at least three, right? There are probably a lot that I haven't thought of, but there are at least three, right? One is sort of the sociological reality that drove the creation of the court in the first place, and that's the victims. In none of these analyses that you see on the blogs, in the states of Secretary Pompeo, and there, none of them are talking about the victimization that this court is intended to address, right? If you look at the 11 situations under investigation or the 10 preliminary examinations, take just one of them, the case of the Rohingya in the Myanmar, you're looking at 900,000 victims. The notion that we would create a special chamber in Myanmar to look at the crimes against humanity and potentially genocide that's being committed in that conflict, I think is ludicrous. So the notion that we've sort of solved the problem the ICC was meant to address, which is addressing the impunity for the commission of crimes under international law, I think is just not a credible idea, because we still have tremendous victimization, even in countries where we don't have ICC action right now, such as Iraq, the case of the Yazidi, or North Korea. The other issue, the second one, is peace and security. One of the reasons that this court was contemplated right after World War II was the international institutions that were being created at that time had essentially one goal, right? Which was to stop future wars. Yes, they were going to promote trade. Yes, they were going to raise standards of living so that the economic uncertainty that fuels conflict would diminish. But the focus on human rights, international justice, creating institutions that could sort of rein in the worst excesses of the war was foremost on individuals' minds, and the ICC is no exception. The ICC came later to the game, and it stresses the political community more because it puts real people in real jails. It's not just going to Geneva and having a debate about something and then getting a set of recommendations. It's an actual criminal court, and so that actually stresses states more. But the need for international peace and security is probably never, I won't say never been greater, but if you look at the continued proliferation of nuclear weapons, if you look at the refusal of NATO countries to even participate, with the exception of the Netherlands, in the latest treaty to ban nuclear weapons, you can see that we haven't quite solved the problem of war. And finally, there are elements of justice and morality that are implicit, that are important in the ICC statute. I don't have time to go into it, but maybe in the Q&A, we can talk a little bit about Rawls and what a real system of justice should look like if you didn't know in advance that you would be born American or Rwandan, or even Rwandan, would you be a Hutu or a Tutsi, right? So I think deeply embedded in the ICC statute is the notion that all individuals have the right to live in peace and security, no matter where they come from. So if I don't think that the court should be abandoned, then how could you reform it? I think there are a lot of things, and I've posted some of these on, there's a forum on the UCLA website called ICC Forum. I have another one going up on their site, as well as two others coming out. I think there are a lot of obvious things. One of the issues that we have is the trial process. Trials are taking too long. We have procedural obstacles to justice at the ICC, in part because when states were creating this court, they were so worried about overreaching that they created a third level of vetting for every case, because the other tribunals didn't have a pretrial chamber. So the ICC has a pretrial chamber, a trial chamber, and an appeals chamber, and we're seeing that it's functioning more like an international bureaucracy than a criminal court. And I don't have time to really go into that, but what had, was hoped in 98 is we'd have this sort of felicitous mélange of the common law system and the civil law system, and together we would create this like amazingly efficient court where you'd have the mise en état of a dossier by the pretrial chamber, a good, fair, and speedy trial, and an effective appeals chamber. And in fact, that hasn't happened at all. So one possibility is just get rid of the pretrial chamber, which actually doesn't do very much at the court except complicate life. And I can talk a little bit more about that. The other thing we're seeing is the judgments of the court. The court's judgments look a little more like ICJ judgments, except they're really short, they're seriatim, they don't issue them all at the same time. In my view, sometimes they get the law really wrong, and even when they get the law right, you can't sense a coherent methodology. And that doesn't mean that we don't have good people. There have been calls for change. I think it's more sort of figuring out what their voice is and how to effectuate that. And a really interesting example that I'll just throw out to this group, if you think about the United States Supreme Court, in its early years, we had a very small court faced with a government that didn't want to enforce its orders. And Chief Justice Marshall at that time started telling the justices to stop issuing opinions seriatim, to issue one judgment, and to issue it so that the court itself presented the law as something stable, predictable, and unified. And that's not what happens here. And so every time we get one of these fractured decisions, like we had last summer in the Bemba case, which I wrote about extensively, you have the opportunity for critics to take advantage, if you like, of the sort of differences between the justices. And I think it detracts from the overall legitimacy of the institution. If you can't figure out what they think the standard is for command responsibility, what is a state's military supposed to do? And so I think we really have a problem with the way that the courts, it's sort of a process problem and it's a substance problem. We also need better state support. I mean, that goes without saying, and I was pleased to see this week when the prosecutor went to New York, fortunately, without difficulty, that France immediately said, and Argentina and other like-minded states said, you have our support, we support this institution, we will work hard to reform it, but that still means we need to get the large non-states parties sitting on the sideline, whether it's the United States, Russia, China, India, to come into the tent, or at least maybe take a slightly more positive view. You know, one of the things that Russia is obviously concerned about is Ukraine is under investigation at the court, the situation there, and Georgia. So that hits a little close to home for them. But nonetheless, we really have to have much better state support. Our own expectations, and this maybe ties into Ivo's work, the court is not a panacea for everything. This is a criminal court that can only act where there's credible evidence that an individual, there's a reasonable basis to believe that someone has committed a crime within the court's jurisdiction. And during trial, that person is proven to be guilty of that beyond a reasonable doubt. It's an extremely high standard, and the court is going to take very few cases. And so we have to temper our expectations. We can't expect the court alone to stop all international crimes. What we can expect is that the court can serve as a beacon and an inspiration and an example to domestic systems and even to new regional courts for the and transitional justice mechanisms for dealing with the problem of impunity. And finally, and this maybe we'll talk about again in the conversation, we have to continue to shore up national systems. National systems are complementary. This court is meant to be in an ongoing and continuing relationship with national systems, some of which need development assistance, some of which need funding, some of which need training, others need law, and we're still missing some tools. So my institute has been working since 2008 on developing a new convention on crimes against humanity, and that's something that we hope could help shore up national institutions. So it's not the ICC alone. One of the ways that the European Union was so successful was as national judges started applying and implementing EU law, it was less foreign law and part French law or UK law or German law. And so we know that the future of international law is essentially domestic. And that's what we have to really insist on in the ICC context. So in conclusion, and I hope I've thrown out a few things, maybe some of which are provocative and which will inspire our conversation, the shadow of this court looms really large. We know that anecdotally, we've seen evidence of people talking about the court and the possibility of indictment. And so we've seen, as Robert Mnookin talks about the law, the shadow of the law, that the court is exerting a long shadow. It's influencing states' behavior, sometimes in ways that we like and sometimes in ways that we don't like. And as Bill Pace said on the dedication of the ICC's permanent premises in 2016, one of the reasons the court is in trouble is because the court is working. It's doing what we asked to do. It's not working perfectly, though, and there are reforms that I've suggested that I think could make the court more effective, more independent, more transparent, and fulfill the expectations that we had for it in the summer of 1998. At the international level, having an institution that focuses solely on global justice has really changed the equation in a way that's hard to quantify, but when negotiations are happening about conflict or trouble around the world, you can see the fact that the ICC is there is important. And we've recently seen several states go to the court with a referral in the Venezuelan situation, just as an example of a situation in which we have one sort of hemispheric superpower sort of half-threatening invasion as a way to solve the problem or economic sanctions, as opposed to another group of states saying, hey, this might be an appropriate case for referral to the ICC. So to my mind, the leave or the destroy campaign, depending on whether it's Bolton or someone else, with an emphasis on sovereigntist concerns, sort of misses the point. We create international institutions like the International Criminal Court to fulfill specific societal needs. There's no evidence that the needs we created the institution to meet, the needs of victims for justice, of peace and security, and the moral imperative of an international legal order that's both just and fair, those needs still exist just as they did in 1998. And nor is it clear to me, at least, that the ICC cannot be an important institutional player in helping to achieve those goals. What the evidence does suggest is that it's time for targeted reforms to help the court to achieve those objectives. For this reason, I hope that more scholars and statesmen and women and academics will sort of lean in to the hard work we need to bring about the reforms, and do so in a constructive manner that has the capacity to strengthen the institution in both the short and the long term. Thank you so much for your kind attention.
Are we doing questions?
Yeah.
Yes, to start the Q&A session, which I'm going to moderate.
Okay,
I think I'd like to
just
take
please
the seat.
Please, please.
Yes, this one's
to
stay.
I have one here myself.
Yeah.
Okay.
Do you want the handheld, maybe? For
can you hear me?
No, not really.
I'll just do this one, and then we can use the roving mics for the rest of this. Can you hear me with this one? Does it work? Not really?
I think you're not. Ah, there we go. I didn't push the button and it transfers.
Hello? Yeah, good. You can hear me now. First of all, thank you very much for this extremely thought-provoking and provocative presentation. There's a lot of food for thought in there, and for the remainder of the time, what I would suggest to do following roughly the format of our OTGR seminar series is I'm going to start with a couple of questions, and I have many of them, but I'm going to limit myself to some basic ones, I guess, to leave some time for the audience to warm up, and then I think it would be great if we can open up actually to the audience as soon as possible, because I know that there are people that bring a lot of expertise from a different variety of backgrounds and regions that can be extremely enriching. So first of all, I want to start with a general question and to tap into the unique opportunity of having somebody who's been following the ICC from its very creation, which is quite extraordinary. So I'm wondering what has changed so much in the last 20 years so that the attitude, or we can see this shift of paradigm or shift of attitude towards the court. Because I agree with you from my own research that it's an extraordinary achievement having created the court, and it didn't go without friction and without tensions. But we had the court, and it seems like the court was not so much in the focus of so much criticism on many different levels, on the levels of NGOs, on the levels of governments, on the levels of civil society, for a lot of its existence. So now we have a situation that you compare to a Leave campaign. And I think there are many different reasons for considering this campaign or where it comes from. But there is a lot of pushback, not only on the governmental level nowadays, but also on the civil society level. So I do wonder, and I have two scenarios here, and I would love to hear your speculation and your very informed opinion on this. Is it that the court has become too powerful, that countries are afraid now that actually its reach is expanding and they can see themselves being concerned, while they did not expect this whatsoever 20 years ago? Or is it the contrary? Is it that the court is driven by internal institutional crisis? With the Bembo Guido, it's attracted a lot of criticism from really hardcore supporters of the court before that. There's a consideration that the court has become so weak, actually, that it's a good time to get rid of it altogether.
Yeah. Well, you kind of made my answer for me. So what I would say is that 2019 is not 1998, right? So we have, you know, first of all, a change in the world that has, the ICC is just one example. The United States is refusing to appoint judges to the WTO appellate body. You have Brexit in the United Kingdom. We have, if you read the transcripts at the Security Council right now, you feel like you're back in the Cold War. I mean, and this is even before we had a new administration in the United States, there was one exchange between the Russian Federation's ambassador and Samantha Power, the former United States representative to the United Nations, that was just reminiscent of something from the 50s, okay? So we have a much tenser, more difficult global climate. We just have to admit that. And the question is how to react to that, right? So I think there are individuals, I probably put myself in the, you know, individuals who double down and say, just because the going gets tough, you know, the tough can't get going. You have to double down, you have to make reform as necessary, but you have to understand that the post-war consensus, in my view, that's just an opinion, in my view, having taught EU law and international criminal law, I still think what we created after the Second World War is important and valuable and has essentially maintained the peace. Not everywhere, all the time. And so I'm very reluctant to throw that out without having something better in its place, right? Because I don't see what that is. I think the other thing is the court's just working, right? So before there have been some personnel issues probably in the court, which have contributed to some of the missteps. So it's not a perfect institution, and human beings aren't perfect. And so there have been, I think, some probably miscalculations on some individuals at the court. I won't name any names. And I think you have, you know, with the academic community, most of what we do is criticism, right? Most of what academics do is critique. I'd love to encourage more academics to create. I've been teaching for a long time. I was a practicing lawyer before I taught. I think creating the court, establishing international institutions, figuring out constructive ways to solve problems, which is how I was trained as a lawyer, to me is just more interesting. But that's not the core of often what the academic community does. It's just easier to rip apart somebody's judgment and say, oh, you didn't footnote this, or I found this piece of reasoning.
insufficient. And so I think that's just natural. And some of that just goes with the territory, right? I'm not worried by people criticizing judgments, and but it's when they decide that they want to take down the whole institution that you realize there's got to be some serious reform. And there's some very sort of elder states people who have now called for an independent panel of experts to assess what's going on in the court and make recommendations. And I think that's a great idea. Actually, the ICTY and the ICTR both struggled at the beginning of their, the ICTR especially with corruption allegations that were quite serious. And bringing in an independent group to say, ooh, we've got to clean shop a little bit, I think is a great idea. Yeah.
I want to pick up on this lawyerly aspect that you mentioned in the very end and pose a more concrete question and then open to the floor. So if you have questions, do. I see that there's some already, which is great. And something that I found particularly provocative in your presentation was the concrete suggestion about reforming the court and especially targeting the pretrial chambers. Mm-hmm. And I found this a very interesting idea. Indeed, I've interned at the court briefly myself, and I know that there was a lot of internal disagreement about the role of the PTC. So when you say that that abandoning the PTC model can be advantageous, how do you envisage this reform to take place constructively? Is it going to lead to strengthening the Office of the Prosecutor straight away with regard to the opportunity of opening up investigations? Or how is the workload of the PTC going to be distributed within the architecture of the court?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And I'm not the only one that's sort mm-hmm. of taken a hard look at the pretrial chamber and saying, maybe we just need to. Because the difficulty was, I think it fulfilled two separate goals in the minds of the drafters. One was a check on the prosecutor, and just sort of a way to make sure that he or she didn't overreach. That function states are still gonna insist on. That's gonna have to be somewhere, whether it sits in a trial chamber or something else. And that was necessitated by the decision to add the propria motu power into the statute. So the United States fought that idea, and they didn't want a propria motu prosecutor. And honestly, I have to say, and again, I'm speaking in my complete personal academic capacity, I never understood how it would work, only because if you can't get at least one state or the Security Council to support you, how can you conduct investigations, right? And in a way, I disagree with the Afghanistan decision from pretrial chamber. They kicked out the Afghanistan investigation, actually, and said you can't go forward. But that was sort of one of their rationales, is how are you going to get, you can only investigate if states allow you to investigate. This court has no police force, right? It says the French call it justice sans police. There are no police attached to this court. Everything has to be through state cooperation, which is an inherent weakness of the court. And they tried to make it stronger by giving the prosecutor the power to bring the case, but she's always going to be stuck with the state cooperation problem. And states are going to want that kind of vetting. But the other thing, the other aspect of it, which is maybe the worst aspect, so that's one piece of it, is how do you keep the propria motu power of the prosecutor in check? The other was this idea that it would make the cases faster, right? Because you would actually have the pretrial chamber have this little mini hearing and confirm the case. And we have seen so much litigation ending up with years and years and conflicting answers in the Bemba case about what does this confirmation of the charges actually mean. At the ICTY and the ICTR, or probably here in the UK and in the United States, the prosecutor files their charges, the case goes to trial. Boom. It's just not that complicated. At the ICC, it has turned into a true nightmare. So even if you just got rid of that confirmation process, which really wasn't about tying up the prosecutor, it was, the theory was it would be like the French investigating judge who would sort of put the case in order so that the trial could be faster. And in fact, I mean, I don't know about the numbers, but it's probably added 2 to 3 years to every case. And we saw in Bemba, they reversed on appeal a case that was confirmed because they didn't like the way the confirmation decision was done in the first place. So I think that's just untenable. That would be, so I think you'd have to sever those out. Does that make sense? Like, one is about making the cases go faster, and it's not working, so just get rid of it. And the other is the reining in of the prosecutor. That is working, but it's generating controversy. Yeah.
That's very insightful indeed. So let me stop the recording first so that the
Q&A